8 straight wins, now 3 straight losses. Just what kind of hockey team do we have here in Columbus? I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Thomas Bradley. This is After the Score.
Welcome back to After the Score from WOSU Public Media. I'm Steve Brown alongside Thomas Bradley. This week, we'll examine college athletes trying to unionize. Do they have a chance? And what would it mean for the future of college sports?
And the Ohio State men's basketball team loses to Penn State. Our back and forth segment looks at the Buckeyes' struggles and the Browns' choice of Mike Pettine as new head coach.
But first, the Blue Jackets. So the Blue Jackets. Mm-hmm. They were hockey's hottest team for much of January, peeling off 8 straight wins. Now, not so much. They've lost 3 straight, including games to Ottawa and Buffalo, 2 of hockey's worst teams. We wanted to know which team is the real Blue Jackets, so we called Columbus Dispatch beat writer Aaron Portsline.
I think they're certainly rattled a little bit. Not so much are they capable of winning. I don't think they're there. I don't think they were ever there, even at 5-10, at the start of the season. I just think there's... Maybe there's some soul searching going on around the room because they thought that they were beyond these sort of letdown performances, both blowing a lead in Raleigh and then getting off such a poor start at home. Having said that, this is professional sports. This happens to every team. The Chicago Blackhawks are in a funk right now. The other teams are desperate as well. But for Columbus, it's the fear of them not being a good team never quite is too far away, given the history of the franchise. So a speed bump, and it could just be a speed bump for now, is always considered to be a much bigger issue than it truly is. They've got a chance now with Washington and with Florida here the next 2 nights before they head on the road trip to kind of get their house back in order again. Before they head out west, and should be a real, real big challenge heading into the Olympic break.
Monday against Carolina, the Blue Jackets gave up 3 third-period goals to blow a 2-0 lead. Saturday they gave up 2 shorthanded goals, one of the most embarrassing plays in hockey, really. And they give up 3 goals Tuesday night to the Ottawa Senators. Is the defense and goaltending something holding the Blue Jackets back right now, or is that one of their strong points still?
Bobrovsky wasn't sharp. I didn't think he wasn't good at all against Buffalo. I didn't think he was great in Carolina. He was pretty good for 2 periods, but then, boy, when the wheels came off, they really came off. And, of course, McElhinney went last night. I thought McElhinney played fine last night. He made every save he should have made. He didn't make any, superstar saves, but he didn't let in any bad goals either. The thing for me is they – and I saw signs of this actually in the last couple of games of even the winning streak, where they weren't as defensively aware, as defensively precise as they need to be when they're playing well. I think the players have said this as well. They may have gotten away with a couple of wins there that they didn't entirely deserve during that winning streak. They did have some lucky bounces. They just have to get back to checking and skating, being a straight-line team instead of a team that tries to get too creative and make too many passes, which I think you saw last night. There was a little bit of – there was some cutesy stuff going on rather than skating hard, skating through people, and playing a very direct, simple game, which is how they found success.
In your game recap, you quoted Brandon Dubinsky as saying the team lacked maturity and a killer instinct. You think that was just a heat-of-the-moment comment, or do you think that's true? Or, I guess, even more importantly, does the team think that's true?
You have to know Dubinsky a little bit. When after a game like this, when you see him sitting in his locker stall with sweat dripping out of his hair and his forehead, and he's biting his bottom lip, as a reporter, your instinct is to drift over into that area because he's about to go off. I don't think he was wrong. I think there's something to it. I think it's in some way explainable. They have a extremely young team, one of the younger teams in the league. I think there's a tendency with young players, but also with some varsity veteran players who haven't been through it, to sort of relax when they get to what they perceive to be the top of the hill. They sort of take a deep breath and think that they've made it. And, you know, pro sports is a great humbler at times. When you think you've made it and the foot comes off the pedal, you can really, really get it handed to you. And now the challenge for them is to get back on top of it. I think there were maybe, I don't know, bad habits or maybe a false confidence was created by that 8-game winning streak, which to some level is probably to be understood. But they've got to get it back together here and pretty quick, because the Metro's the most difficult conference in the NHL, but it's a traffic jam right now. It looks like an Atlanta highway right now, if you will, in the middle of that division.
timely reference.
You mentioned the Metro division. There's six teams in that division within a couple of points. You know, as a Blue Jackets fan, you're watching two other Metro division teams, and you're almost just rooting for it not to go into overtime. How log jammed it is there.
Well, it's a fascinating thing, and it's only going to get more intense. One night, Blue Jackets fans will be rooting for the Devils, and then the Devils will win two games in a row, and then the next night they'll be rooting for the Rangers to beat the Devils. And it becomes this frantic, manic affliction that carries you well into the spring. And, you know, I mean, the thing, you're right, it should all be at this point, because it's so tight. If you're a Blue Jackets fan, you would be rooting against a 3-point game. Just keep it a 2-point game, mm-hmm. So you don't have those false points out there. Those are, I mean, look at Washington. I mean, you could take away Washington's overtime and shootout points.
Right.
If those games have gone the other direction, they're below the Islanders. I mean, it so affects the standings that it allows the traffic jam to become so compacted. You're rooting for two point games more than you're rooting for or rooting against any individual team.
Now, Washington has 11 overtime losses. Is that what I saw, or something like that?
Crazy. That's crazy. And I think they've had almost 20 games that have gone beyond regulation. 20.
That's crazy. Okay. Everyone seems to be talking about it, and we haven't seen it in three games, but we need to talk about the hug. And I think you know what I'm talking about, and maybe not everyone knows what I'm talking about. But after a Blue Jackets win, there's a hug between two players. What is this?
Well, there's actually a lot of hugs, but to quote Nathan Horton, who is a Blue Jackets forward, and let me just back up a little texture here, or context anyway. After a win, the players come over the bench, and they always form a line and congratulate the goalie by various means, fist bump, pat on the head, hug. Sometimes you get the classic bro hug, like we might do, the right hand.
Yeah, you got to make it tough. You got to like slap their back while you do it.
Right. They kind of like, you know, but then there's like, you know, aunt and nephew hugs, which are like robust, big double arm grab kind of job.
Yeah.
But anyways, Nathan Horton always gets to the back of the line. I'm sorry, Nathan Horton. Nick Foligno always gets to the back of the hug line, if you will. And the crowd's not getting into this. Everybody says what they want to say to Sergei Bobrovsky, and then here comes Foligno with both arms wide open, and it's a big, big, like they haven't seen each other in 10 years.
A flying hug. It is a giant bear hug.
Exactly. And to quote Foligno, my hug is always last, and my hug is always the grandest.
a little known fact, Thomas and I do the same thing after every podcast.
When we finish a show, we look at each other like we haven't seen each other in 10 years, and we embrace.
It feels like it.
It's sweet.
Aaron Portsline covers the Blue Jackets for the Columbus Dispatch. Aaron, thanks again.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, guys.
The NFL, NBA, and Major League Baseball all have player unions, and have for decades, but not college athletes. They're considered students, not employees, and have been repeatedly blocked from unionizing by the National Labor Relations Board.
But there's another effort afoot. Northwestern University football players recently voted to ask federal labor officials for recognition as a union.
For more, we called Lester Munson. He's a journalism professor at Northwestern and also a legal analyst for ESPN.com. Mr. Munson, in a legal sense, what exactly are Kane Coulter and the other Northwestern players doing here? In the most minute details possible, in the smallest details possible, what are they doing here?
What they have done is each of the players in this group have signed a card that is then filed with the National Labor Relations Board in Chicago, and if there are a sufficient number of signed cards, then the National Labor Relations Board will hold an election that the board will supervise, and the election will determine whether a union would be formed to represent the Northwestern University football team. The university and possibly the NCAA will seek to intervene in this process and stop the process under the theory that these players are not employees and instead are students, and under American law, as students, may not form a labor union in the traditional sense of a labor union. So
they're trying
to have initiated a process that will quickly become contested.
So they're trying to unionize athletics at Northwestern.
They most certainly are. They have decided that the only way that their voice on a number of issues will be heard is to form the union and then to speak as one for, at the beginning, all of the football players, and then if they're successful, all of the other athletes on the other teams at Northwestern.
The sports website Deadspin called it the opening shot of a major new assault on the NCAA's amateurism model. Is it that big of a case? Are we talking about that important of a landmark case here?
Yes. Deadspin is absolutely correct. No matter what happens here, even if Northwestern prevails over these young men at the National Labor Relations Board, this is a significant shot at the NCAA and the way the NCAA does things. We had a previous opening shot at Grambling State University in Louisiana, where the football team went on a wildcat strike, refused to play against Jackson State as a way of demanding better conditions, better practice conditions, better coaching, and better everything at Grambling State University. That was the first indication of a kind of labor mentality among athletes. Now we have the Northwestern athletes, and this is part of a huge picture of reform possibilities for the NCAA. There are court cases, there is legislation in the United States Congress, and there is player activism. All of this is going to produce a different kind of NCAA over the next 5 years.
These Northwestern players want to unionize, presumably for all the benefits of it. What's the biggest benefit for them unionizing? Is it getting paid and being considered employees? Is it having sports-related injuries covered via workers' compensation? Or is it just the principle of it, being recognized as an employee? What do you see as their biggest motivation here?
I think it's a little bit of all of those, with the possible exception of getting paid. These Northwestern athletes are saying they are not interested in pay at this time. They keep the possibility open for further down the road. But the primary interests of these players are coverage for injuries. The leader of this group, for example, Kane Coulter, he was a quarterback at Northwestern. He has an injury that requires surgery. His football career is over. He has absolutely no way now to have that surgery and to pay for it. The university is doing nothing for him, even though he was injured while playing for Northwestern. They are also interested in setting aside money for future medical considerations. Concussions would be the primary diagnosis there. What happens to a college player who at age 45 or 50 begins to have symptoms of dementia or some other concussion-related situation? These would be guys who do not play professional sports. And they are interested also in representation in the decision-making about the team and about the athletic department. They want to be, as the kid said, they want to have a seat at the table when these things are going on. If, for example, a player is subject to discipline, they want to have a method for appealing and for due process in the consideration of the discipline. These are all the it's all the typical things that a working person would want from their union.
You know, these players have a case. Northwestern, much like Ohio State, are both in the Big Ten, and these football teams make millions of dollars for the university. So it's not like these players and these teams are costing the university a lot. So do they have a case for, you know, workers' compensation and stuff like this just based on the amount of money they're bringing in for their universities?
That's a very interesting question. There is no doubt that the amount of money generated by a football team like Northwestern, even more so at Ohio State, there's no doubt that that money causes people to look at things in a different way. If the money were not there, I don't think these guys would be thinking about a union. The money in and of itself will not have any effect on the decisions on whether the union is valid or not, but it's obviously the motivating factor. And the you mentioned workers' compensation. That if they are employees and they have a union, then automatically they have workers' compensation, and then injuries, medical bills, hospital bills, all of that is then covered. That would be an enormous reform and improvement in the world of college sports.
This is happening.
I don't think they're going to get their union, but they are going to get some of these things in other ways as this moves along.
This is happening at the same time as two U.S. representatives, including Democrat Joyce Beatty from right here in Columbus. It's coming at the same time as they're pushing for major changes to the NCAA to create a structure for legal payments to NCAA players. Are these cases intertwined at all? Do you think the outcome of one affects the other?
I think they're totally intertwined. I have been following that Beatty bill. She's got a Republican named Charlie Dent who is helping her on that bill. It's a bipartisan bill. It has surprising support in the United States Congress. This is something that cuts across party lines, cuts across liberal and conservative lines. It's very interesting what she is seeking to do, and I can easily see how that bill and what these boys at Northwestern are doing can come together and provide legislation that will accomplish through congressional action what these guys are trying to do through their union. They are both moving in the same direction. They are seeking the same things. And all this going on at once indicates there's going to be some level of success here in this reform effort.
Lester Munson is a journalism professor at Northwestern University, where football players recently voted to unionize. He is also a legal analyst for ESPN.com. Mr. Munson, thanks again.
Thank you, guys.
The Ohio State men's basketball team might be the worst in the Big Ten right now. I can't believe I'm saying that, but they are terrible. They've lost five of the last six, including games to such basketball giants as Nebraska and Penn State. They were leading Penn State by 11 with 8 minutes to go and just couldn't bring it home. And Thomas, I'm becoming more and more convinced this team will not make the tournament.
Losses against Nebraska and Penn State are one thing if we're playing football.
Right.
But basketball, that's just this Ohio State team is bad. And I think Lenzel Smith said it best at the end of the game. Top 25 teams don't lose at home in games like this.
Oh, they do.
They do if you're Ohio State.
Yeah. They were at Nebraska, right, at least when they lost.
They lost at Nebraska,
yeah,
yes.
They lost to Penn State on Wednesday night in Value City Arena to Penn State. Who's Penn State's best player ever? Calvin Booth, I suppose? John Amici?
Or now DJ Newbill, who hit two big shots against the Buckeyes last night.
Oh, Penn State. Yeah, I can't believe I really couldn't believe it. I have the first shift here. I have to be at work at 4 in the morning, so I don't stay up and watch most of the games. And I was astounded when I woke up and saw it.
The last 25 minutes of the game, so part of the first half and the second half, Ohio State made 8 field goals.
That's very Ohio State. That's the Buckeyes were Buckeyes-ing so hard last night.
This team can't close. They can't score, and they can't close
they
games.
They can't shoot, yeah. If you give up 71 to Penn State, too, you evidently can't play defense.
72-68 overtime loss to Michigan State. 84-74 loss to Iowa at home, 63-53 loss to Minnesota, 68-62 loss to Nebraska, and now 71-70 to Penn State.
The other three are somewhat acceptable to Minnesota, Michigan State, and Iowa.
To a team that was ranked number three? This is a number three ranked team.
Anymore. That's absurd. They shouldn't have been ranked three.
But right? obviously.
Yeah, I guess it's cyclical, but yeah, I understand losses to Minnesota, Iowa, and Michigan State.
Minnesota, we're justifying a Minnesota loss at this point. But what has Minnesota ever done in basketball?
Vashawn Leonard. That's before your time, I suppose. But against Nebraska and Penn State, that's comical.
This is a bad basketball team. This is a team that's going to struggle in the NIT tournament.
They could roll up the NIT. 2008, baby.
Yay! We win the NIT tournament. Congrats in Madison Square Garden. It means absolutely nothing. It's the worst consolation prize of all sports.
Go Buckeyes, go Buckeyes. It lost in this news, at least in the last few days, all this news of Ohio State at the bottom of the Big Ten, and with the Blue Jackets being hot, cold, hot, cold. The Browns have a new head coach, Mike Pettine. The great Mike Pettine.
Oh, I've heard of him before this week.
Yeah, if you can't get Bill Cowher and John Gruden, you always ask Mike Pettine next.
The defensive coordinator for the Buffalo Bills?
If there was one position you have to poach from the Buffalo Bills coaching staff, it would be defensive coordinator. I'll give them that. They had a pretty good defense last year.
They had the third best defense against the rush, but their pass defense was horrid. But we have Joe Hayden, so...
Yeah, name one safety or corner on Buffalo. You can't.
I could barely name one on the Browns.
Well, yeah. Well, at least this guy got out of Buffalo. Kudos to him for that. And Jim O'Neill is the defensive coordinator. He was an assistant defensive coach under Pettine. And they're evidently interviewing Kyle Shanahan, the man who likes to flip people off in Washington. They're interviewing him to be offensive coordinator. And also, this is a fun name to say, John DeFilippo. John DeFilippo. Mastermind behind that dynamic Oakland Raider offense.
Well, he's been given like gifts and Terrell Pryor as his quarterback, and I don't blame him for a terrible offense in Oakland.
Yeah. Getting back to Pettine, did you see his daughter tweeted, "It's the Browns, but hey, still pretty cool."
The most passive aggressive tweet about the Browns ever. Hey, my dad's a head coach, but it's the Browns. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's like when someone walks up to you and they just say, "Hey, I noticed you've been trying pretty hard lately." That's a perfect backhanded compliment right there. And also, have you seen the trailers for Draft Day?
I have not.
The Kevin Costner movie. It's kind of it's about the Browns. Kevin Costner is the GM and comes in and takes over the Browns. This is his feel-good story about the Browns. But it just adds to every stereotype about the cartoonish Browns front office.
What choice was Pettine on their list? Like
Was he on the list? Did he make the list?
was he choice 10? Was he choice 12?
Hey, you know what? He's pretty good. I don't know. He might be okay. You never know. What do you know? On the plus side, he looks just like that angry guy from Storage Wars.
Yes. The bald guy with the goatee.
Jared.
And,
spinning image.
And his wife, Brandy, on Storage Wars. I know way too much about Storage Wars. This is a revealing moment in my life.
So anyway, this Mike Pettine, new face of the Cleveland Browns. Go Browns. And that will do it for another episode of After the Score from WOSU Public Media. You can always find us at WOSU.org/afterthescore and on iTunes.
You can also stream the show with the WOSU Public Media mobile app. Until next week, I'm Thomas Bradley.
And I'm Steve Brown.